You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Well, especially if you're trolling today, or you're going to be trolling, sometimes a fisherman's best friend are the birds. And today we're going to talk about birds. Actually, for the next couple weeks in this segment, we're going to talk about birds. Not only protected species, not only one kind of bird, but all kinds of bird. And not just here. We're going to go out throughout the district, even all the way to New Zealand, and learn about some birds there. So we have a couple of experts with us, including Asuka Ishizaki is back. She is the protected species coordinator at the council. And today we're going to talk about for the birds, and mainly seabirds, and their interactions in Hawaii's longline fishery. Boy, Asuka, first of all, nice seeing you again.
Thanks for having me back. Yeah,
always a pleasure. But secondly, I've often said this, and we say this as trollers all the time, no birds, no fish. There's something, and we're out to catch fish, and you see the birds and you think, boy, they're having a nice time. They're not having fun, are they? They're working.
Yeah, they're definitely looking for food. Yeah. And where fishermen are a lot of times is where the birds want to be too.
Yeah, but doesn't it work in both sides? In other words, sometimes a boat can come upon fish where there are no birds. And just by their activity, one little birdie from a mile away will see it. Tell all the birds and they'll all be over there.
Yeah, yeah, and fishermen do that too. They look for birds and they know that there could be fish there. So there's definitely a co-occurrence there going on.
I want to learn a little bit about their behavior. And it's not random, helter-skelter, right? So what are we going to do today? What would we like our listeners to know about birds and more importantly, how they interact with us?
So today we have a couple of folks with us who have experience working on longline boats and seabird interactions in longline fisheries. And I know we talk a lot, we've talked a lot about the different types of bird issues mm-hmm. that this fishery in Hawaii have dealt with. But today we have an expert here who has been watching birds on those boats who can talk to us more about those behaviors.
Okay, and let's make a little line of parallel, because sometimes you and I in the past have talked about interactions not with birds but with turtles, with loggerheads and with leatherback, with turtles that determine the fate of a whole section of fishing depend on how many of these interactions we're talking about. Is this the same thing? We're talking interactions, not fatalities in most cases.
So with seabird interactions in longline fishery, depending on the sector of the fishery, mm-hmm. we do, for the tuna fishery, there are more mortalities that do come back. We don't have the same type of management scheme, though, for the seabirds. The two primary species that we interact with in the longline fishery, the albatrosses, the Laysan albatrosses, and the black-footed albatrosses, their populations aren't considered endangered or threatened.
So smart, huh? I mean, really, they don't waste much time or effort, do they? They kind of know what there's going on.
Yeah. And so that's why we don't have, you know, those limits kind of thing that really stop the fishery. But we have a number of measures in place already that help keep the birds away from the boats and try to minimize that.
Yeah. And we're going to find out what the perils are. In other words, those that do not make it as a result of an interaction. We'll tell you some of the why for us. But first, I want you to meet our guest. Holly Nahua is the field coordinator. What does that mean? We'll find out in a minute. And we're going to talk about the Tory Line Cooperative and Research Project, which is something about these birds. And also David Goad, he's from New Zealand, eh? And we'll be talking to him as well. But first of all, I'm anxious to find out, Holly, because I found out a little bit about you, that you have been a observer, not just for a summer vacation or two, but for a couple of years. How did you get into that in the first place? And did you think you were going to stay in it as long as you have?
I got into the project with Aulike, which mm-hmm. is a native Hawaiian program that gets Hawaiians into meaningful careers. Did that and loved it and thought that I'd stay here for a while.
Okay. When you say you thought you'd stay here, where are you from originally? What island?
Oh, I'm from Oahu.
Okay.
I'm from the west side.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And I bet you that your friends and neighbors and relatives, when you first told them that this is what you're going to do and you kept doing it, were they kind of a little bit surprised? Or have you always been like an adventuresome person or what?
Yeah, I've always been adventurous and I always try things that are different and new. But they wanted me to quit, especially when the hurricane started marching across the Pacific.
And especially when you're on, you know, I mean, sometimes a boat looks pretty big, right? But when you get 1,000 miles away from land, not very big anymore, right?
Yeah, it's like the boat's meant for bathtub.
Okay, now I want to make sure that people understand life on a longline boat as an observer. It's not exactly a piece of cake. For instance, were there times in the beginning that you had to develop sea legs? Because not everybody can do that. Not everybody can be on a rock and rolling boat for many, many days.
Well, for me, it was easier. I never really got horribly seasick. Mm-hmm. And before becoming an observer, I did work as crew on the tour vessels.
Yeah.
So,
but however, that's a lot shorter time on the water, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. But I feel that kind of prepared me for being out at sea.
Okay, now, just so that people know, and we could do a whole program of this, Asuka, right? Because people really want to know. Typically speaking, if you went out on either a sword vessel or on a longline, you know, a tuna vessel, about how long are the trips?
The trips on the tuna vessels are about 20 to 23 days. On swordfish vessels, it's about 32 plus.
Okay, and gang, there's no 7-Elevens, there's no drive-ins, there's no pizza places, right?
No.
So you got to kind of bring your treats with you.
Yeah, you bring your treats with you and you hide it in your bunk so nobody else can find it.
Yeah, it's mutiny. And just so that we get one more taste of it, speaking about taste, generally speaking, because everybody knows fishermen work hard for a living, what kind of food is usually eaten on these long trips?
Oh my God, it depends.
I'm sure a lot of fish.
Yes. Yeah. I used to hand line off the bat.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And so I'd catch mahi and aku, things like that. Yeah. That was fun.
Mm-hmm.
You always have fresh fish, and for the other stuff, it just depends who your captain and crew is. So if you have a Vietnamese captain, you have Vietnamese cuisine.
Right.
If you have, you know, Filipino crew that cook all the time, you're eating adobo.
Everything, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, adobo fish is pretty good if you've never tried it. It's not too bad. And since we're going to talk about food a little bit too, let's also talk to David Goad. He's from New Zealand. And interestingly enough, similar situations, but I'm going to guess right off the bat, before David, what got you into it? What got you interested in fishery in the first place?
I was fishing in England for a while, then went back to school.
Are you a Brit? I mean, or are you from England or from New Zealand?
I get hassled both ways. I was born in New Zealand and grew up in England.
I'm married to a Brit. She was born in South Africa, and she's here. And when somebody says, you're from New Zealand, it's fighting words.
I ended up going back to school after fishing for a while. Mm-hmm. Did some observing over in England. And while I was studying, I met my Kiwi now wife. Yeah. And so that was it, out to New Zealand. And about six years observing in England, in New Zealand, sorry. And have been doing more sort of individual contract work around seabird mitigation.
What got you interested in the birds? I mean, all of us that fish, we have this uncommon respect for birds. We really sort of know their value. What got you going in that area?
I think they're just pretty amazing creatures. You know, they come to land basically just to have babies.
Yeah, not that often.
And then that's it. They're just their whole lives.
But you know what? Most people get this. Let me see if you got this in the first place. Holly, you too. And Asuka, we've talked about this. When you see the birds, like you're trolling, and you see an Eva bird or you see a pile of birds and they're working the tuna and you get in there and you get your fish. When you get one on your boat, aren't people amazed? Boy, these things are big. Some of them are pretty big.
Some of the big albatrosses.
Now, do you in New Zealand, are they the same birds or similar birds? Are the birds that you were looking after different?
Yes, different species. Mm-hmm. We have our fair share of albatrosses.
Yeah,
different species to those encountered by the Hawaiian fleet.
But meaning the lay sand, you don't see them
we don't see those so much. But they behave in a similar way. Mm-hmm. But we also have a lot of shearwaters and petrels, which are much smaller birds, still reasonably large if you caught one in the hand. And they are a lot more agile, and they can. People say they dive, but they can swim underwater.
Yeah, you know,
they can sort of half fold their wings in.
That's rather unique, right? Because our birds around Hawaii are not the deep divers. They'll dive a little bit, and we'll talk about that. But you're talking about birds that can go down.
Yeah, it's pretty hard for an albatross to get its whole body fully underwater.
Because they're big.
But these guys, and you know, the ultimate example for us, I guess, is it's called a diving petrel. And it sort of looks a bit like a duck, but the boat comes up, it just disappears underwater.
Isn't it amazing when I've seen video of these petrels, and I've seen some up close. It's amazing that they aerodynamically shrink their body. They're coming down. It's like a dart, isn't it? I mean, their body is like, it's like a weapon. They go underwater and stab them.
Yeah, so more like a booby, I guess, or a gannet for us. They can sort of be looking around 100 feet up.
Mm-hmm.
And then fold their wings in and dive in. But some of our birds will actually spend a lot of time sitting on the water and then fold their wings up, duck under, and actually, I think of it as swimming. You know, they're kind of like a spear fisherman underwater. Yeah. They'll just happily go around, swim around, and have a look and go hunting underwater.
Yeah, and you know, they are fascinating. And let's, Holly, for a minute, spend some time on the fact that, you know, there are some problems. And, you know, and so like on a longline boat, is it sometimes that they're after the bait? Do they get snagged? What happens to them? What's the biggest danger around a boat?
The biggest danger for the bird? Yeah. The biggest danger for the birds around the boat would be the baited hooks during the setting period,
okay,
I would think.
Because they haven't submerged yet? They're still sort of, they haven't completely submerged on the set?
Well,
the bait I'm talking about.
Yeah, they're casting the bait out on one end, and if they don't have any coverage over the casted bait, the birds can fly, land on the water, and then dive
Unbelievable.
Down. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're resourceful, right?
Super resourceful, and they're really smart. They're very, very opportunistic.
Atsuko, we could talk for hours about the experiences that these two have had and really, really enlighten people, but let's talk about why this group got together. What's the purpose of some of the things we're trying to do? Obviously, mitigate mortality, but you know, what valuable information are you all learning?
So we're getting together right now on a project to develop toriline standards for the Hawaii longline
fishery.
Spell
that. What is it again?
T-O-R-I, okay. Line, toriline, okay. Which tori comes from the word bird in Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a measure that has been used in other places where you're essentially dragging a line behind the boat to keep the birds away from those baited hooks and try to keep them from getting caught on those the hooks and get drowned as a result of it.
And you know, maybe we can rely on both Holly and David here for the expertise. Is when you are trying to unhook one, I mean, when you get a bird, isn't it very, very difficult? Because these things are, can't they be kind of fierce?
Yeah, the problem is if it's caught at the set, it's behind the boat.
Yeah, and
it's gone.
What can you do?
You can't stop.
Yeah.
You can't turn around, and it's gone. I've only seen it once, really, actually pulled under.
Isn't that saying a lot? Because you would think that, you know, with something so tragic, it could happen a lot.
In New Zealand, we night set pretty much exclusively.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of visitors.
Ah.
One of the reasons we're night setting is for the birds. Yeah. So we, as an observer on a boat, we don't spend a lot of time watching the set because there's not a lot to see.
Yeah, there you go. That sounds like my kind of job, Atsuko, you know. I want to be observer on a boat in the dark. Then I can take a nap. Nobody's going to know I'm taking a nap. What about here, Holly, in our fishery? Is it at the same point that this interaction takes place? What have you seen? Because you've done this a lot.
Yeah, so a lot of the birds get hooked during the haul for swordfish fishing.
During the haul?
Yeah.
Meaning when you're retrieving the line?
Yes.
Okay.
And those birds come up alive, and they're really aggressive and fierce. And
I mean, one you know, what we've done a couple of times is throwing a towel over it or something, so you can sort of hug it to get the thing out, but they get pretty cranky.
You just have to be really quick with it. So when they come on deck, they're just kind of discombobulated. They're all over the place.
Yeah.
And you just kind of hug them around one wing and tuck in the other wing and then hold
them. I bet they're
down.
Happy campers when you let them go. They're, thank you. That was terrible. That hurt. Yeah.
I mean, so swordfish, like, they come up alive, but this project is for the birds that get caught on the set.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they get caught on the set, like how Dave Gold said, we can't turn back.
You can't turn back. Yeah, certainly not stop that thing. But Asuka, I think that it'd be kind of interesting when we talk about the boats that are seen around, the birds that are seen around boats here, it's limited. It's not a whole bunch of them. There's basically two. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, it all depends on where the vessels are fishing and what time of the year. But compared to, you know, like New Zealand or other places in the Southern Hemisphere where they have many more species of birds and just more greater abundance of birds where they're fishing, a lot of times, you know, they don't even see birds or it's just a couple of birds just flying around. But there are, you know, times when they are fishing around quite a few birds. And that's really where we found that a lot of the interactions happen. So when there's more birds around the boats, then there tend to be more interactions, probably in part because they do become kind of competitive and it probably increases their...
Everybody that's listening to trolls knows that. If you start to get it, you get in a bird pile, and if it's active, if they're not resting or sitting on the water, if they're working the bait and you're working the bait, it's like a symphony. They're screaming at you, you know? And I know that that's what gets the... David, that gets the adrenaline going through, doesn't it? When those birds are going nuts, you know you're going to catch fish.
Yeah, I think the birds hear each, and certainly from what I've seen in New Zealand, the birds hear each other. When they start squawking, it's almost like their common sense goes.
Is there,
and that's a dangerous spot.
On your observation, is there a point where you think these things are pretty organized? I mean, it's pretty social. They know what's going on. It's not just they're all happen to be flying together. Are there patterns or things that you can observe that you know what are going to happen when they happen?
Yeah, sometimes you can... You can see problems coming before they do. And I think it's probably fair to say that because we have so many birds in New Zealand, fishers are getting really good.
Yeah.
And they've obviously got a lot of experience because they're out there doing it every day and actually learning to either stop or not go there in the first place.
Yeah. Isn't that kind of what in an ideal world that would be, you know? I mean, see, here's another thing, and I don't know if people understand this or not, but you're always told as a skipper, or I learned as a skipper many, many years ago, when you see birds, you drive your boat to where you think they're going, not where they are. You know, because if you go where they are, by the time you get to where they are, they're gone. So you have to sort of guess them. Have you noticed a social structure? Are there leaders?
Yes, but we don't have that same schooling behavior for our tuna feet in New Zealand.
Okay.
Our fishers are finding fish based on watercolor, water temperature, historic knowledge, and feeling their way around as a fleet. So they're quite good at talking to each other. And so most of the bird interaction we have is birds seeing and smelling
what you're doing,
the fishing vessels and the fishing operation, and coming to check it out and see if it's an easy option for food. And
isn't that amazing when you think about it? You would think it'd be the same, but it's not. You know, I mean, it really isn't. I mean, sometimes we find our birds to find the fish. And what your birds are doing is finding you by the smell or anything.
Yeah, I'd say that's generally where the birds around the fishing boats come from.
Is there any science or anything to support how far these things can smell or how far they can see? I mean, everybody always knows that birds in flight have a tremendous range of vision. They can see probably a lot better than most of us, particularly what you're talking about before, the ones that dive underwater. Because don't they have to see under there too?
Yeah. I'd love to know in the air how far away they can find boats. I've spent a lot of time on the back of fishing boats counting birds and had zeros. And then had ones and twos, and then be in the tens and twenties and thirties. And so those tens and twenties of thirties have seen the ones and twos at the boat. I don't know how they do it, but it's miles and miles, hundreds of miles probably that they can scan and
that's true. That's just tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah. To earn a living, that's what they have to do.
A friend of mine once told me years and years ago that they rely on jet streams and airflows and everything else because they cover so much ground. And a lot of the times you think they're flying, they're not, they're cruising, they know where to go. I'm interested, Holly, in doing a comparison from what David was saying into what we know happens here. What are the things that you can tell us about the behavior of birds around the boats that you've been on as an observer?
Well, like David, the longline fishermen don't really go looking for the birds in our fishery. They use their spidey senses at times to see where the guess at where the fish are going to be at. They use thermoclines, charts, and they talk to each other to find the good fishing areas. However, birds do overlap.
Well, you know what I'm guessing, and Asuka, I think we've talked about this, because of technology, our fishers are in way better shape to find things and locate things and go back to things. But back in the day, before GPSs and before all of the things that are navigational aids, how did these skippers ever find the birds again, you know, or ever find the fish again? That's when I would imagine that there was more of an emphasis placed on birds at that time.
Yeah, and I think in general their experience over time and that being carried on from fisherman to fisherman. But even in this fleet today, I think there's a lot of variation in how much technology captains rely on. Some of them probably will rely on a lot of that data that they can get from different places, or otherwise, you know, they may just talk to another captain and go try to find fish.
Well,
otherwise,
you know, everybody knows I often have the guys from Wicked Tuna on the program, and where they start sharing numbers and things, even though it's a reality show. Once they catch their fish, they're more likely to tell somebody, come over here, there's some fish over here. But before that, we're talking their enemies. Let's talk about the birds themselves for a minute. Holly, what have you seen with regards to our albatross? What do they eat? I mean, basically, what are they searching for to eat? What kind of fish? Any kind?
Well, I don't know what kind of fish, like, exactly that they're looking for, but it's smaller fish. They eat squid, crustaceans. Yeah. They do forage a lot, sometimes at night, sometimes during the day. They also go for discards. So if swordfish is caught, it's floating at the surface, they'll go for that, maybe a whale carcass, whatever they can find in forage.
Wow. That's really cool. So, Asuka, before we wind up for this episode, let's make sure that what we know is, so far it's been nice learning a little bit, but what's next? I mean, what are specifically these projects we're going to talk about next time?
Yeah, so, we've been talking about the birds around the vessels and, how they come after bait. And, you know, I mentioned that we do have mitigation measures in place. Right now, what the council is doing is taking another good look at those measures and saying, how can we improve it? Because we have seen a little bit of increase in the bird catch in the deep set tuna fishery.
Okay.
So that's where the Tory Line project has come in, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to do next time. And by the way, if you want to know about this time, you go to WPCouncil.org, WPCouncil.org. So for Holly Nahoulava, and David Goad, our visitors, and of course Asuka, I'm Mike Buck. We'll see you next time. If you want to hear something on the show, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com, or go to WPCouncil.org and learn about this and a whole bunch of other stuff that goes on. See you next time.